Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast, Side Note, by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science, where wherever you get your podcasts.
Ever since recorded music became a big business, artists have been getting screwed by their record labels. This is not a secret. Ask anyone who pays attention to the industry, and they will give you plenty of examples. Outside the industry, though, it's not usually public, unless it really interferes with an artist's ability to make music. And even then, it's never this public.
Lately, there's been a new shift that has affected me personally and that I feel is a potentially harmful force in our industry. And as your resident loud person, I feel the need to bring it up. And that is the unregulated world of private equity coming in and buying up our music as if it is real estate. This just happened to me without my approval, consultation, or consent.
You might recognize that voice. It is one of the richest voices in the world. So yes, Taylor Swift can afford to take a risk. She used her acceptance speech when she got the Woman of the Decade honor at the Billboard Awards to address her very public feud with Scooter Braun, who is the new owner of her former label Big Machine, and along with that, the owner of dozens of songs Swift recorded early in her career. So what happens now? Is this a new precedent for the music industry, with artists speaking openly about who owns the art that they create? Or is this Taylor Swift doing it because she's Taylor and she can? And how will her former label and Scooter Braun fight back? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Amanda Kingsland is the National Music Director for country music stations on Rogers Radio across the country. She's been following Taylor Swift since Taylor came onto the scene. Hey, Amanda.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing really well. And why don't we start with, do you remember when you heard Taylor Swift for the first time and what you thought?
I do remember, actually. It was the first few months I started here at the radio station. We received her album in an envelope with a bit of a plan. It kind of came with this rap sheet that said who she was and what the plans were for her. You know, this would have been maybe early 2006. So kind of pre people sending you an email with all the details. So it came in a big envelope. And I remember sitting down and listening to it. And I remember some of the songs thinking, like, this is a little kid. And I remember some of them thinking, these are incredible lyrics. I remember immediately falling in love with the song Teardrops on My Guitar. I thought it was really, really smart how her first single, Tim McGraw, resonated and how they were able to use that to really get a foot in the door in country music. And I remember being here at the station when the phones blew up asking who that girl was or who sings that song that talks about Tim McGraw. Or she resonated with people immediately. And you don't see that a lot with artists. You know, you see having to play them a ton, especially in a time where social media wasn't where it is now. There wasn't a big social campaign or digital campaign to put her in front of people. They did that organically, and it caught on so quickly.
Where did she come from, and how did she come up in the countryside of the business?
Well, Taylor grew up in Pennsylvania on a Christmas tree farm, which I always think is such a cool fact and just very authentic in the country lifestyle, I think, to grow up in the woods or growing your own trees. Turned to songwriting really early. And obviously her parents were super supportive and realized that she had a gift because they brought her from Pennsylvania to Nashville in the early 2000s when she was about 13. She got a publishing deal with Sony at 14 years old. And then signed a record deal with Big Machine Records from there. And spent time writing songs and then did what you kind of often hear people do and went from label to label, asking to play songs for people and asking for a record deal. So that's sort of how things got rolling. You know, she went up and down Music Row pitching her songs as a 14-year-old with a guitar.
Wow.
And got told no over and over and over. So Yeah, I think that that's a really, that's a very, you know, picturesque story you would hear about somebody going up and down Music Row in Nashville, asking, you know, knocking on doors and asking to play their songs.
Right. It's like the quintessential origin story. But then she signed with Big Machine. And what happened when she was just getting started with them that matters now, like why we're talking about it today?
Yeah, well, I think that how Big Machine started is kind of important to this too. Big Machine was not a record label pre-Taylor Swift. Scott Bruschetta left his current label, who wasn't interested in signing a 14-year-old writing her own music, which was a caveat in how she wanted to do things. And so he decided to start Big Machine Records, and that launched with Taylor Swift. And, you know, I've heard Scott's sister actually worked for the record label for years with us on the Canadian side. And she told me about them sitting on the floor of an office space he had rented, and there was nothing in it yet. And he had called in some favors from some other people in the industry, and they actually were putting Taylor's albums in envelopes on the floor in this office space and mailing them to radio stations hoping for airplay. And that's sort of how Big Machine started, was with Taylor. What wasn't talked about in those early days when she signed that record deal, which was 2006, was, you know, that part of that deal was that the publishing rights to the songs that she was singing were owned by Big Machine. Every person has a different deal, and every person has different publishing houses or how they get songs and how those are broken down as far as royalties go. It's all different for everybody. So I guess, you know, at that time, it didn't really matter. And then fast forward a handful of years and a whole lot of success. And, you know, Scott's selling the label, which involves Taylor's music and the rights to that music. So that's how we end up here today, where we're hearing this buzz around Taylor not getting to perform her own songs, or Taylor, you know, not owning that music that we all have come to love, and why she's where she is today.
Can you explain a little bit about how those rights work? Because I think some of us who, you know, listen to music take for granted that different people might own the actual rights to a song, but I haven't heard ever before, really, of somebody not being allowed to play their own music.
So just so, you know, we can clarify that rights means copyright. It means, you know, licensed music. And that means that the publishing rights would earn you money when it's streamed, downloaded, put on a CD, performed live, heard on a radio station, used in a television show. Anytime you hear that song, whether it be live or recorded, somebody is getting paid because it's been licensed. So that's what we're talking about when we say, you know, not owning the rights or not having the rights. Now, because of a breakdown of how those come together, and again, it's different for a lot of people in how much percentage they get of each category. And by category, I mean there's a lyricist or a songwriter, there's a musician who pulls that all together, and then it's published through a publishing company who copyrights it, who gets a percentage. So, you know, in Taylor's case, she may be collecting royalties as a songwriter, but she doesn't own the rights to those songs and doesn't get to control. Unfortunately, with those albums she released with Big Machine, she doesn't get to control when those songs are used because she doesn't have those rights.
Right. So they can sell them to a commercial and she can't do anything about that.
Right. Now, as far as I understand, if they were to do that, she would still get a portion based on being the lyricist or the songwriter, but she doesn't get say on how it's used.
So how did this escalate into the kind of public feud that we've been following for the back half of this year?
Well, you know, in my opinion, Taylor Swift is an incredible business person, and she always has been. Even when she was on good terms with Big Machine and sitting in those boardrooms, she was very active in the decision making. So I don't know that not having the rights to these songs became a problem until she wasn't in that boardroom anymore. But she's always been outstanding to her fans. She's cultivated this incredible following. She gives so much to those people who then she can in turn ask things of as well. And when this became a problem for her, she was able to turn to her fans through her social platforms and let them know what was going on and request their support to get her to where she wanted to be. And, you know, as much as there's so many people have so many opinions on this, but quite frankly, it's quite brilliant to use this fan base that she has and that she's cultivated to get the results she thinks that she deserves or needs to see. And I think that's how we all ended up hearing about it, is Taylor making us all aware. And again, that's one side of the story when Taylor comes out and makes us aware of what's happening. But it started with the company being sold, or with majority share of Big Machine being sold to Scooter Braun. And she was unhappy with that. And then she disclosed the publishing and how what the breakdown was, and how she doesn't have control over those songs. Everybody loves to hear her sing.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
So what is Taylor claiming she wants done? Like, what does she say happened, and how does she feel she's been wronged?
I've seen a lot of different lines, a lot of different coverage on this situation. And I love reading because I'm a big geek for the industry. But, you know, it's hearsay to a certain point, because we're hearing from both sides, and you know, the saying is there's three sides to every story. And so we've heard from Taylor, and we've heard from Big Machine in the way of Scott Borchetta or Scooter Braun. And then there's actually what happened. And that part's a little bit fuzzy. But, you know, Taylor's not a fan of Scooter Braun, and she's been very vocal about that. She's had her issues with him in the past. She was very unhappy that's where the company landed, was in his hands. And she, I think, felt maybe betrayed. From what I gather from her, what she's expressed, she felt betrayed by Scott, that of all people, that he would sell her music and the company that started, you know, on his back, but on her music, to somebody that she really didn't trust in the industry. So I think that's really what fueled the fire initially. But how it's escalated, I think the fact that it's gone public, the fact that there's so many hands in the pot, I think that's what's escalated it to the level where we see it now.
Do we have any idea what happens next? Like, is there something that could resolve this? Is there a next step that either Taylor or Scooter or Big Machine would take?
Well, I have heard that Taylor, after there's some sort of cooling off period, or there's a time frame coming up where she will actually be able to re-record those songs and have ownership of them. I'm not 100% sure what that time frame is. It's been reflected differently in different outlets. But I know that she has said that is her plan, to re-record some of that music so that she has control over it again. So, you know, that's exciting from a music fan standpoint, to know that there'll be other versions of some of your favorite songs, whether it be Love Story or whether it be Fearless or some of those mega hits, that new versions will come from those. You know, she's on a new label with a new record deal, took things very differently this time around. Obviously, going from being a 14-year-old to someone in their mid-20s, she's learned a whole lot. So I think we're just going to see different decisions made, different processes happening. And I think that this happens all the time, where somebody loves the idea of a record deal and they sign it, maybe not understanding fully what's going to happen, or maybe understanding and that working for them in that time frame. And as they grow and evolve, it no longer works for them. And that's why we see people change labels, start their own productions. And so, you know, I don't think that part surprises me. The thing that stands out the most for me is how public she felt she could be. I think that's, again, a testament to the relationship she has with her fans. And I guess how things escalated because of that. You know, when she wanted to perform on an award show recently and was told she couldn't play the songs, she used her platforms and her fans to make it so that Big Machine, you know, to a certain degree, felt pressured and allowed her to do it. From a business standpoint, it's brilliant to be able to have that resource to get what you need for your own product.
Is this going to set any precedent for how artists approach deals that they're tired of, or deals that they wish they'd never signed? Or is this something that, like, you know, to your point, that is kind of unique to Taylor because she has an army of fans?
I can't think of too many artists that would be able to have the power that she has with the fans that she has, with how she's been able to use social media, use her fans, use all of her resources to come together like that. But I think that there's always things that are going to be learned from these stories coming out. And again, even in my standpoint, even being as close to the industry as I am, I'm reading all of this and I'm taking all this in and I'm hearing conversations and I'm kind of drawing my own conclusions or forming my own opinion based on all of that. So I think that you're always going to have people learn from it. You're always going to have people push boundaries because they see somebody else do that. I think Taylor's been a pioneer for that for, well, since she started. From a 14-year-old walking up and down Music Row, there were people who said, I'm going to do that. And then being the youngest female on the most powerful females list or the youngest woman to set records all over the place, you had people say, I'm going to do that too. And I think this is no different than that. I think that people are going to look at their deals, look at how they're making money, look at how they're running their businesses and say, I'm going to do that or I'm going to change this. And she's, you know, she's constantly been a trailblazer. I don't think this is any exception to that.
When we talk about her re-recording these songs, what does that actually mean? Does she have to like change the arrangements or make different versions or different lyrics to make sure that she's not like exactly copying the songs that she doesn't own anymore? Or can she just like do the exact same song again?
I think as a lyricist, she, you know, and this is my understanding of it, but that she's able to leave the lyrics as they are. She wrote them initially. I would imagine the arrangements have to change. I don't know what the percentage is. And I don't know if Big Machine still gets money off of her re-recording the songs. I would imagine that there's just like when somebody samples a piece of a Taylor track in their song, you know, she would be awarded some sort of royalty. So I don't officially know what the breakdown is. I know the songs will come across as different. I would imagine that they would need to in order for her to actually have some sort of separation for you to audibly be able to say, this is Love Story from early 2000s and this is it now. And I think she'd want to do that. She's grown a ton as an artist and this is an opportunity for her to have new music that people will want to consume. And if it was identical, there wouldn't be a point in them, you know, downloading it again or streaming it again. So I think that there'll be audible differences in the songs for sure.
What does Scooter Braun have to say about all this?
What I've seen is him saying, you know, he bought a company and he's always wanting to talk to Taylor about opportunities. What she says is totally different. So, you know, he has the backing of a lot of big artists who have worked with him for years who, when this all initially came out, Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, they all went on their socials and talked about what a great guy he was. So he's constantly talking about how he's willing to cooperate and how he's willing to work with Taylor to make sure they come to a resolution everybody's happy with. That's what I've seen his story be. Again, it's represented differently in a lot of different articles or reports or outlets.
That's really interesting because I didn't know that this kind of had the potential to split some of the megastars in the music industry between into pro and con camps.
Yeah, I don't know that that's happened recently with the sort of resurfacing of the story when Taylor wanted to play that music, play her music at the award show. But when it initially came out that Big Machine had been sold and Taylor was very vocal about her thoughts on that, there were a lot of artists that went to bat for Scooter Braun, a lot of artists that went to bat for Taylor saying, you know, give her her music and this isn't right. It was extremely divided. And I think that's why it caught so many people's attention to see stars come forward and weigh in on something that they felt they could weigh in on, even though maybe they're not part of the initial deal or story.
What do you think ends up being the end result of this in the music industry and for Taylor Swift?
I don't think this is going to affect Taylor in a negative way. Like I said, I think that she's very, very smart in how she does things. I think that her fan base, I know I've said this numerous times, but it's just incredible what you can accomplish when you have people who have your back all the time. So I think that that's phenomenal. I think people, there's more eyes on her. Again, just great business sense. You know, people are watching to see what she does, and she does music so well, whether it's country, whether it's pop or AC, it's just so well done. So, you know, people are watching her even more now, or people are going to watch for these new songs. And it just seems like a really smart business plan to me. I think that the story will continue. I think we're going to constantly see it come in waves because I don't think it's resolved. And I think it's going to take a while before the wounds heal over. I think people were hurt in this process. I think a lot of things were said, and I don't think that's going to go away quickly.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you.
Amanda Kingsland is the National Music Director for Rogers Radio Country Music Stations. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. I hope you have that address memorized by now. If you want to talk to us on Twitter, head to @TheBigStoryFPN. You can yell or scream or praise. We don't mind any of them. And please give us a rating and a review wherever you get podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll be back with something new in a few days.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.